In a world racing against time, where innovation is not a luxury but a necessity, a team comes together to explore the future of medicine.
It's always the same. If you're early and you have a big vision, you can succeed easily.
Meet Dr. Daniel Witt, the pioneering CEO of Immunic Therapeutics, a company at the forefront of developing groundbreaking treatments for chronic inflammatory and autoimmune diseases. Here are the five main points we cover in this episode. The revolutionary potential of Immunic's approach to treating multiple sclerosis and leaky gut, the challenges and triumphs of bridging European and American biotech markets, Daniel's candid advice for stepping out of the comfort zone and embracing risk, the future of Immunic clinical trials, stock prices and global expansion, Daniel's three key lessons for anyone daring to start their own company in the biotech industry. Are you ready to dive into the mind of a visionary? Don't miss this conversation. Watch the full episode now. Daniel, I hope I may address you with the first name.
Yeah, sure.
Daniel, it's good to see you. How are things in Munich these days?
Excellent. Great times. We had a very good year so far, and the weather is supporting that good mood as well. So,
how is the weather in Munich?
Oh, very sunny, dry, perfect weather for improving mood. And also, the only challenge is to focus on business in this weather.
What are your favorite activities in Munich besides business?
Oh, hiking. I think clearly hiking, going outside. So nice here, being close to the Alps.
Mm. Is there a part of the Alps in Bavaria? I guess I've always thought it's the majority is in Switzerland and in Austria. And I think Watzmann. Watzmann is a famous area. I guess
that's Austrian. Huh? No, we have the Buchspitze in Germany. But it's only 45 minutes by car.
Ah, that's cool. That's cool to go. And your business is running a biotech company. Can you tell me a little bit more about it?
Yeah, I think it's a big pleasure for me to really be part of an industry which is focusing on improving lives of patients. Yeah. So, and from the very beginning when I started in that industry, I felt that I can contribute to something good. And that is always every morning if I go to work. I'm usually on site, not virtual, as far as possible. I enjoy being part of that industry and just with the team to help improve patients' life. And now with the molecule in phase 3 that entered a new era, I think, for me and the colleagues here.
Are you back to on-site working 100% of your time, or did you also keep a little bit of remote work in your system at Immunic?
No, I think for employees, you need to be flexible these days. I think I like social interactions, and I think the quality of work is also somehow depending on social interactions. But you can't twist arms today. I'm back in the office. So it's a mixed setup everywhere now, and also here in this company. So, for example, we allow our employees to have 2 days per week as flexi time. So whenever they like to work, virtually, even from the lake, if they work. So
yeah, Munich is famous for the lakes, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is part of quality of life and quality of work. Yeah.
Mm. I couldn't agree more. I personally like hard work, doing alone at home. Yeah. But communication, meetings, it's better to have them in person if possible. There's nothing better than having a coffee, sharing a cup of coffee or tea together.
Absolutely.
What brought you into the life science industry? What sparked your interest?
Actually, it was coming through computers and my fascination of modeling small molecules. So in doing my master thesis and then PhD time, I focused on simulation work. So it had two components. One was quantum chemistry. So what I did is I calculated reaction mechanisms on the computer. And then I needed to visualize, because you can't show big mathematical equations to people that don't understand it. And numbers also annoying. So we spend a lot of time on, for example, then making small movies of reactions, chemical reactions. And the second part, and that fascinated me even more, was to simulate how a molecule fits into a binding site of a protein. And that's something which still is the core of what we do and what I do and I'm fascinated about. And so this is a so-called key and lock principle we have in biology and chemistry for small molecules to fit into a site in a protein, and then preventing an interaction or executing or starting an interaction or triggering something. That's, I think, the way how we now more and more understand how the human body is working and how diseases are affecting proteins, and that we can use these molecules to cure or to improve the situation.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, now you mentioned that during your PhD and master thesis, you started simulating the interaction of proteins and also produced small movies, which I think when I look now on LinkedIn, very often I hear the term artificial intelligence, AI, and there is a whole industry evolving around these topics to just look deep into that part, which is more or less a service industry. And you now are CEO of Immunic, which is clearly a therapeutics company. So your goal is to cure diseases. What led you from the simulation aspect then to a company like Immunic, where I say, okay, I want to focus on developing therapies and not staying in the simulation area?
You mentioned that exactly what drove me at that time is not staying somewhere. You move. And if you start with simulation and you see a small molecule fitting into the active site, so for example, if you have this little piece you're fitting here, it is something which is bringing you to the question, okay, can I do that? Then the next step is to synthesize a molecule. And as a chemist, I'm trained as an organic chemist. So as a chemist, you of course should think about, okay, this was on the computer, but what about real life? So getting back from the virtual world to the real world. And based on that, I started my first company with three co-founders in 1997, starting from the computer work and then implementing that into the lab. The company is called 4SC, which is still existing. But at that time, it was purely a technology company. And then we transformed it step by step to a company, then implementing the chemistry and the biology, the screening, the testing, then progressed further and qualified molecule for development, and then built the preclinical development and the clinical group. And so the whole thing, the whole pharmaceutical development chain was starting from the computer and now is in approval stage, more or less. So with our most advanced molecule coming from that technology long time ago, now being tested in a phase 3 registration study, I think that's a smart thing. And it really can drive satisfaction as well, because you say, okay, you have an idea and I transform it to something which may at the end may really help patients to be approved as a drug. And hopefully we see that approved in the next 3-4 years.
That's a good point. Small molecules, chemistry. When I started in life science in 2006, my first touch point was a company that was more or less focusing on chemistry. And then I learned in the industry that part of it switched to biology, biological drugs. Some said also chemistry, you don't need it anymore. Where do you see the perspective of chemistry in drug development in life science?
Well, I think we now have a steady state situation where maybe 40% of molecules which are originating as drugs are small molecules, another 40% are biological molecules, antibodies, and then the remaining 20% is now cell therapy or something fancy stuff, which is neither small molecule nor biological. And this will always be a dynamic thing. But definitely the time of small molecules is definitely not over, not for the next 50 years, because we just start understanding what are the targets and how can we really understand selectivity and it's still a big challenge to find selective good molecules, either biological or small molecules. And also it's a question of what indication is it. Is an infusion an option for a disease or not? This really depends on the disease. And I think what we are targeting here is chronic diseases, autoimmune diseases, like multiple sclerosis or ulcerative colitis or celiac disease. So indications which are lifelong diseases where patients want to have a treatment which is improving their life, but on the other hand, are not accepting side effects, which may cause more trouble than the indication or the disease. And this, there is still a lot of room for improvement, I think, in all of those indications.
So the time for chemistry is not over, and it's still playing a crucial part in the industry and will do so.
And like everything in the world, there is a place for something new and there's something established. I don't think that anything can really get rid of this hype curve. So you have this over-enthusiastic introduction of new technologies and they find then their place. They play a role, but it's a dynamic thing.
Yeah, especially in public markets, there's always a bubble phase. I think we see it now a little bit in artificial intelligence.
Well, or now we will with these more gene editing technologies and these things. The question is, where do they end? The important milestones of technology, and I think they're super, super helpful. But what is at the end the practical use for treatments? And I think it's still too early to really judge.
When I worked with the first companies, I had the luck or bad luck or fortune, it depends on how you look at it, of 2008 happening. It's basically one of the biggest crises, financial crises that we had. And all companies I was aware of back then that had venture capitalists on board, private companies were sized down to one product, one trick pony companies. And we didn't really have, not far as I know, many pipeline companies, and Immunich these days, 2023, is definitely no one trick pony. Can you tell me a little bit more about the pipeline that you have in your company?
I think, thank you for that question, because it's something I think is absolutely important for our industry. We need to live with success and failure. We are doing big experiments, which are quite costly. We do clinical trials, and there is no guarantee that something we developed in the lab or on the computer at the end really work out in the patient setting. And therefore, a company like us needs a pipeline to balance the risk, to have multiple shots on goal. And therefore, I believe we need that diversity. On the other hand, having too many things makes you defocused and doesn't help you to have enough enthusiasm and drive for your key assets. So we have three products in development, which I think is somehow an optimal number for a company of our size. So we have three programs, I said, and the most advanced molecule is vidofludimus calcium. It's a small molecule, which is super selective and is currently in phase three clinical testing for treating multiple sclerosis. Multiple sclerosis, it's a really important and frequent disease. A lot of young patients are affected by that. It's a lifelong disease. Maybe we come to that a little bit later. Mm-hmm. So something of really highly unmet medical need. And in our focus is, how can we improve the current state of technologies? So what's there? What current treatments are there? And we believe that, for example, neurodegenerations or the destructions of neurons, that is still the key problem in multiple sclerosis, and slowing down disability worsening by neuroprotective effects. That's something where we want to deliver something better for the patients in the future. So that's the most advanced molecule. It's set in the registration trial. So the next step after completion of this, hopefully successful completion of the study, maybe anti-25 to early 26, we then want to submit NDA and get market approval, market authorization for the drug. We also run another trial with the same molecules to support scientifically the story and going a little bit beyond relapsing MS. So we test also the same molecule in progressive MS patients. That's a different indication. So the patients don't have the relapses, but they are worsening on their physical abilities over time, some very quickly, some slower. But the current drugs really don't help there. So that's an area of super high unmet medical need, with quite a number of patients affected by that disease. So these are the two things for MS. And the second molecule is IMU-856. So that's a lab code still. We don't have a name for that yet. It just successfully completed the first test in humans with celiac disease recently. That was a couple of weeks ago when we published the first data. And it was so good that we ourselves were quite impressed positively surprised by the data. Because it's an important piece when you, for the first time, switch over from a healthy volunteer to a real patient, then you enter the area of excitement here. Is your drug really enough exposed? Does the new mode of action work? Do you have an effect already in this 4-week treatment? So there's a lot of uncertainty when you start these phase one studies and then start treating patients. But it came out so nicely that you still see my excitement about the data which came out.
Absolutely. I think we Europeans are not, the Austrians are not very good with excitement. I think the US industry experts are always exaggerating and are so excellent in showing excitement. We as Austrians is just like, okay, yeah, it's well done. How is it in Germany?
No, we are more Austrian than American, I think.
Let's stay a little bit with your pipeline. You mentioned multiple sclerosis. Isn't it a disease that Michael J. Fox is suffering from? This is Back to the Future. He became famous in the 80s when he was a boy.
I thought it was Parkinson's disease.
Not
too far away, I think. We just reported data and published data together with Daniel Merck's group here in Munich on vidofludimus calcium. Mm-hmm. Showing that the drug is affecting a neuroprotective molecule protein called NUR1. NUR1, it's a nuclear receptor. And this is a target which was originally discovered as a potential Parkinson's target. And I think therefore MS and Parkinson's share some of these properties leading to neurodegeneration. And what we have shown here and published is that vidofludimus calcium is an activator of NUR1. Mm-hmm. And with that, we believe that the drug can prevent neurons from cell death. And that should be applicable to multiple sclerosis, as we are doing right now, but should also work in Parkinson's disease. So there is, I think, a link between both where therapies may help both.
How does it help the patients at the end of the day? What is the difference that you make with your drug?
Yeah, I think so far, and now it gets a little bit more scientific, but so far, until 2 years ago, the majority of researchers and treating physicians were convinced that relapsing MS, so the form of multiple sclerosis, which has these episodes of relapses and remissions there, that the overall worsening of the patients was associated purely to the relapses. So meaning, okay, you're doing well, and then you figure out you have a relapse. So for example, you find out that you have problems with your vision on one eye, and you go to the doctor and you find out, oh yeah, you're diagnosed with multiple sclerosis now. And over time it goes back, but not fully back. Yeah. So you have a continuous worsening of the physical ability, then walking problems and so forth, going further, maybe ending up finally in a wheelchair. And that it was believed that this is really associated to the relapses. So there's always some remaining disability from the relapse episodes. One of the leading scientists in that space, Fred Loveland from Mount Sinai in New York, published last year a nice paper where he evaluated 35,000 patient cases treated with different drugs. Mm-hmm. And the data was thankfully provided by Novartis. to him. And he had a closer look on what is contributing to the disability. And he had all the data available. And he found out that half of the disability worsening is coming from something independent of the relapses. Mm-hmm. So the whole industry, including myself, were a little bit misguided before that time point, because we've just focused on the inflammation. We focused on the causes for the relapses. But we didn't pay enough attention to demyelination of the neurons and the threat there and the loss of function of neurons, leading then to this underlying, more smoldering disease, which is not linked to relapses and remissions. And this, by the way, this is called PIRA, and this is now an established established concept. Luckily, and this is the story of serendipity, and serendipity needs a mindful person. And serendipity that we found out that vidofludimus calcium is having both. It has an anti-inflammatory effect, but with this activity as an activator of Nurr1, which we published recently, we also know the drug has these effect. And therefore may really improve. This is the goal here, to improve time to disability worsening for the first time. And that would really open up a completely new era of treating such patients.
So basically your drug can stop the progression of the disease in certain cases. Is that...
Right. This is the ultimate goal, to slow down or stop progression. And of course, I can't say the drug is doing that in a big style. We have hints for that from our phase study, where we have seen, and we treated around about 250 patients in the phase 2 study for 24 weeks, so half a year time frame. And first, this study was looking on inflammation. So we did MRI tested and looked for lesions in the brain as a primary endpoint, which was highly significant and very nicely worked out. But then we followed up the patients also beyond that 24-week treatment. And we looked, for example, if a patient was worsening on the disease scale for 1 point, we looked whether this is going back to normal, which is remission, or it is still there. It's an ongoing loss of function, basically, or disease worsening. And then we looked if patients after 12 or 24 weeks of confirmation still have that or not. And this is the endpoint for such trials. So it's called confirmed disability worsening. Mm-hmm. And we were surprised to see that our drug had a remarkably lower, the patients on drug had a remarkably lower disability worsening rate than the patients on the placebo group. It was 3.6% of patients on placebo versus 1.6% of patients on active drug, which I think is a pretty nice signal that a drug has actually these neuroprotective effects. But scientifically, it's difficult to say it has. This is the root cause. We see that drug is doing good and it's better than what others have shown so far on that respect. But that's not what we ultimately want to prove in the phase 3 study in relapsing MS. And in the phase 2 of progressive MS as well.
Maybe we can walk through the clinical phase 1, 2, and 3 trials to demonstrate how a drug like yours evolves through the clinics. I think everybody has graduated from the Bild-Zeitung in the last 2 years in understanding how vaccine development works. And now maybe we can help people graduate with my podcast also in therapeutics. But let me ask you first another question. You mentioned a very interesting a sentence that I like. Serendipity needs a mindful person. Can you dive a little bit deeper into that? Why do you think it needs a mindful person?
Yeah, I think, not sure if you know this picture. Serendipity means that you're searching for the needle in the haystack, but you find the daughter of the farmer. So need to be at the farm. And therefore, if you're unprepared, you will never not see it. And if you're at the wrong place, you will not find it. So an open-minded person will see signals in a clinical trial. or in research, which may hint to a totally different thing than you originally were looking for. Mm-hmm. These serendipity findings, I think, are super important. And this is not just luck. That what I say, it's not just luck. And you will never see any effect if you're not prepared to see something like that.
How challenging is it? I mean, when you look at the data, is it a clear signal that you often see in the data, or is it more on the weaker side that you really need a lot of elaborated people to look at the data and find the needle in the haystack?
I think serendipity findings usually are clear signals, else you would not do that. In contrast to if you're searching for something, you may be too biased sometimes to look for something. And sometimes we start to ignore statistical analysis. So I know this. So I think serendipity findings are usually the stronger ones. Mm-hmm. So Viagra is a good example for that. There was a serendipity finding.
But what I'm curious about to learn is how do you find the right people then in your scientific advisory board or scientific board? When you get data, basically it's a bunch of files these days, PDFs, and then you show it to people. What's your magic that you play as a CEO in putting the right scientists together to come to the right conclusion that move the project forward to the benefit of the patient?
Yeah, I think you need to have the right people around you, which means internal. So your team should consist of people which are scientifically driven, science driven, which are open-minded, not too arrogant, self-reflected. But also you need the right advisors around you. And you mentioned KOLs. And I don't want to overstate here, and I don't want to earn some fruits of others. Actually, our clinical team, specifically Andreas Müller, our chief medical officer, he was pretty good in really connecting with the key people in the world on sclerosis, and also true for ulcerative colitis and other indications we work with. Or celiac disease, we have Fonzi, our medical lead in for the celiac disease program, is super nicely connected to the really leading group of clinical researchers in the world. And you need this because you need to test the relevance of what you do, and to really know, am I on the right track, or do I just repeat something? Do I reinvent the wheel or the TV or whatever? Or is it something really new? What is the need from the coming from clinical practice? I think that's so super important that we stop doing things which are useless at the end, even if we think it's cool.
Yeah, that needs a lot of leadership, I guess, to get the right people on board.
Yes, and I think it also needs it's a cultural problem. So a company needs to somehow have that open mindset to come to that point. I think Immunic is a good example where a new team which is collected together can really do better than an established old setup where things are getting a little bit more difficult on the political side.
Let's move from leadership now to the data side, to the scientific side, and to the operational side of how to move a compound forward. As an example, your drug in multiple sclerosis. What did your drug show in the phase one study? What was the endpoint that you wanted to prove with that study?
Yeah, phase one is a safety. Yeah, this is the first in human study. This is an exciting moment. You give a new drug to patients, to healthy volunteers in this case. In cancer development, it's patients, but here it's really healthy volunteers. And you carefully look if it's well tolerated. You start with a low dose, with a very low dose, and you then increase the dose stepwise to test, do I see symptoms of side effects, toxicities, or tolerability issues? And then you more or less establish a dose where you think it's well tolerated. At the same time, you also measure how much exposure the volunteer has. And therefore, you can calculate and you can use computer modulations, for example, modeling for calculating, okay, I achieve already a range where the drug should be efficacious. And this is information you then need. Okay, it's safe and has enough exposure, then it qualifies to go further. If not, then you need to stop there. despite spending a couple of million, then you should stop there.
Did you also include in the phase one setting patients already, or was it totally healthy volunteers, so without any efficacy signals?
For vidofludimus, it was really a healthy volunteer study. For our second molecule, INU-856, the molecule we tested now in celiac disease patients, we did the more accelerated way. So we first started with healthy volunteers, first a single dose and then 14-day continuous dose. And then as a third part in the phase one, we already included patients, in this case with celiac disease, a very small amount. So this is not something where you put hundreds of patients in. It's a phase one study. So you want to learn how is safety in patients. Safety in patients can be different from safety in healthy controls because, for example, in celiac disease, the patients have an impaired bowel function. The gut wall is somehow not in good shape. And therefore, for example, nutrient uptake is not optimal in these patients. Therefore, it can affect the uptake of the drug as well. So that therefore, it was part of the phase one. But we also had a look on symptoms. Yeah, so we also had a look on the histology. Do we see an improvement, or can we protect patients with the drug from damage of the drug of the gut wall? We also looked on symptoms of disease like nausea or diarrhea, which are typical lead symptoms for celiac disease. Also looked on biomarkers like IL-2 or citrulline. And the fourth dimension, which was, I found the biggest surprise here, was the functional readout. So we looked also for vitamin B12 uptake in the patients. And we were really surprised to see that even despite this was a four-week study, and we even used gluten as a challenge here in the study. So we actually gave the patients the antigen and looked, can we prevent the onset? So it was tough for the patients, I think, because they needed to agree prior to the study that they are willing to accept to be punished by us by giving them gluten. But this was really needed to really make sure we can test whether the drug works or not to help the patients maybe at a later time point or in other further studies. So, and we have seen that the drug was in both treatment groups was able to improve the uptake of vitamin B12 substantially. And I think therefore this phase one was very helpful in giving a quicker answer whether the drug has a relevance or not.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
How many volunteers did you have in the phase one trial for this setting, and how many of them were patients?
Yeah, all in all, I think we had around about 100 patients, and 42 were patients with celiac disease. And they all volunteered in despite being challenged with the gluten. And interestingly, only five patients dropped out from the treatment associated with the gluten challenge.
How many people in the Western world suffer from this disease?
Yeah, there. If you look on what's available as information material, something like between 1 and 2%, maybe 1.6-1.7% of our population has celiac disease. Interesting, this is a disease which is not just a Western disease. This is a global indication. It's everywhere in Asia, Africa, Europe, US. So it's a pretty big thing, and maybe to focus on the relevance here, that the biggest problem is maybe helping patients which adhere to a gluten-free diet, because currently that's the only way to deal with the disease, is really to to stick to a very strict gluten-free diet. But something like 25 to 47% of patients, of celiac disease patients, have ongoing active disease despite gluten-free diet. And these are the poor guys, because you have that limitation of your life quality by really being limited to gluten-free food on the one hand, but on the other hand, you still have symptoms. So that's something where they really need to have help. And also, on the long run, I think having lifelong celiac disease increases risk of cancer, increases risk of other long-term diseases. So it also has a negative impact on your life expectations at the end. And therefore, it's a real disease with a lot of patients affected. So in Europe and in the US, you have around about 2 million each. And there's no treatment despite gluten-free diet so far. So we think that need to be changed. And therefore, we used also celiac disease as the first proof of concept indication for IMU-856.
So it's either a vegan lifestyle or taking your drug then at the end of the day to enjoy the European versions of cakes and bread and rolls and all these things that we have.
Everywhere, basically. It's mainly bread and these things. So it's wheat is, I think, the main source of gluten.
Yeah, it's Sachertorte in Vienna.
That's definitely something you have problems with. And gluten-free Sachertorte maybe is not the nicest thing to eat, but it's maybe better than nothing. Mm. So yes, but this treatment should really goes beyond that diet. Yeah, I think patients with celiac disease will need to adhere to gluten-free diet for the whole life. No way out there.
Okay.
But there, we may at least offer a first option to then be out of symptoms, free of symptoms of diarrhea, nausea, and so forth, and malnutrition. I think malnutrition is a big problem. Vitamin B12 is one thing, but there's something like iron metabolism. So anemia is a side effect there. So there's a lot, which really doesn't make the life of severe celiac patients nice.
Yeah, sounds like that. And when we move forward then with your drug into a phase two setting, what's the goal that you want to prove in a phase two?
So if we just limit phase one to, let's look on safety and tolerability and PK, then in phase two, we are testing activity. Do we see a therapeutic effect? Mm-hmm. And therefore, now in the phase two, our current plans, which are not final, but our current plans are to use exactly that population of ongoing active celiac disease patients, mm-hmm, despite gluten-free diet. So we want to include such patients in the phase two study and treat them for at least 3 months. And then look whether we can improve their histology, their symptoms, nutrition uptake, and biomarkers. So same things we have seen in phase one in the patient portion, now in a bigger test set of patients. And here really what you want to achieve is a statistical significant improvement, meaning that your treatment group should behave better than the placebo control group in the phase two.
How many patients do you need? I think, did I understand it right? 100 was in the first study. And
well, the first study was three studies, basically. Now in the phase two, usually this has something like 200 to 250 patients, could differ a little bit. This is all based on statistical simulations at the end, but around about 200 to 300 patients, maybe it's the right scale for a typical phase two study. There are differences, but this is in the autoimmune field, usually the size of a phase two study.
And for your multiple sclerosis drug, what is the study size? What was the study size in the phase two?
In phase two, it was 250. Mm. And now in phase three, it's 1,000.
1,000?
A study, yeah.
How many sites?
Oh, we currently have 150 sites for two studies, aiming to recruit 2,000 patients into altogether, yes.
In Europe and the United States, I guess.
Oh, it's all over the world, meanwhile.
Oh, this must be a nice piece of work.
It is. It's tough work.
Yeah. What are the main challenges, in your opinion, in doing a multi-center, multinational, global study?
I think not surprising these days, distribution chains are a problem.
Or still? Are they still a problem?
Yes, because it's if you have a blood sample and want to bring that from a lab in India to a testing site in Belgium, and you have only 48 hours to do that, that's a challenge. So logistics is still, it was always and is still a challenge. But of course, at the end, it's recruitment. You need to really quickly have enough patients available, which fall into the criteria of treatment and qualify to be included in the study. And I think that the team is really doing a great job here in talking to the local doctors around the world. So they're traveling a lot. And it's important to speak with the investigators on the site to tell them about neuroprotective effects, to tell them about the experience in clinical sites at the phase 2 study. We're really excited about what they have seen here as a therapeutic benefit for the patients. Mm. So that they know about the potential of the drug and can educate the patients about the benefits of entering such a trial.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Coaching Conversation 2024. This podcast is 100% dedicated to leadership and leadership within the workplace coaching area. We work with companies throughout the world teaching leaders how to coach their employees. This podcast is dedicated to teaching specific strategies, frameworks, coaching models, and now artificial intelligent strategies to help leaders drive greater teamwork, collaboration, cooperation, greater attitudes, better motivation, coaching career development, just to name a few. I hope you'll check out our podcast.
It's a lot of leadership again. So it's, I think it's not only that the patients are there. You can just say that now you know you have to join the study. It's needs probably also a lot of convincing to try something new.
It's a very human thing. You can't rely on machines and computers only. It's a personal thing. You need to establish a relationship between the management of the company and the employees, the treating physicians and the patients. And even the press or social media, like we're doing today, to make people aware that there is a medical need and people are suffering. And we need to come up with answers. And to do that, we need to do clinical trials. Else there will be no new medicines in the future. And somehow this is forgotten in the public awareness that if we talk only about pricing of drugs, we forget about the need of new drugs for unsolved problems. And therefore, this is a quality of the discussion. We also want to contribute to make sure that we get people aware about these unmet medical needs.
Mm-hmm. No, that's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. And I think social media is a good place these days to help spread information and reach out to people.
And therefore, you're doing a good job on this and to really make sure you get a broader understanding of these more complex things where we usually as researchers tend to stay at home and work rather than talking about it.
Yeah, and for retail investors and institutional investors, it helps sometimes to simplify the science to a point that they can digest it very quickly. And I think it helps moving things forward, which is really challenging sometimes in science. How do you see the challenges of scientific communication in your company?
Yeah, I think the challenge of the company, I think the company is good on this end. And we have a good team in trying to translate it into messages and to get awareness there. That it's more a legal issue. As drug developers, you're somehow bound to a legal environment, which is really preventing advertisement for drugs which are not yet approved, all of these things. So somehow you need to be over careful on these things. Talking to investors is not a problem, but talking to the public may be misinterpreted as advertising for a drug, which we don't do.
Yeah, we need to talk to raise awareness on one hand. So
yeah,
I think we need to do that. when we look at your pipeline again, so your compound IMU-856 in celiac disease is in phase two, if I understood it right?
Well, it completed phase one with patients, so it's in between phase one and phase two.
Yeah, it's a limbo state.
We are now preparing a phase 2B study, meaning this 250 patient thing, where you really test for a dose-dependent effect of the drug. So we want to find out what is the right dose strength of the drug for treating celiac disease as the next point.
But the data of the phase 1 trials were solid, so that your scientific board recommended to move forward in the phase 2 study, and you are currently in preparation state of the study.
Yes, it was overwhelmingly good. So it was really, you know, last year we had a failure. We had a failure of one of our drugs where at the first two doses tested, it didn't work out. That's also part of our life. This was a bad day. If you find out that something is not working as you calculated, as you projected, and you thought it is, here it was different. Here we tested that in this very small amount of patients, but every data point was moving in the right direction. And the holistic view is really, this is a new treatment option. It's a new mode of action. We didn't speak about it, but this is, for celiac disease, it will be a new kind of treatment, because what the drug is doing, it is helping the gut wall to renew. So it's more targeting the natural function of gut renewal, and therefore reestablishing the proper barrier function in the gut wall. So that the antigen can't cross the gut wall. So the gluten degraded peptides are not crossing the gut wall on the one hand, but also we repair the function of the gut and therefore indirectly repair the onset of the disease.
So we are talking basically about leaky gut syndrome, or is it?
Oh, that's exactly what we are working on. It's more fixing the leaky gut. Yes. And this is done without immunosuppression, and that is new, I think. It's a different way to solve the problem compared to what's currently believed to be the right way to do it. And given that leaky gut, or so-called leaky gut, is, I think, a problem not only in celiac disease, but also in patients with ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease and other stuff like that.
And sorry to interrupt you out of curiosity, and your drug candidate has the potential to restore the gut wall. I hear that right?
Without immunosuppression. So this is really, it's an epigenetic regulator of SIRT6 protein, and it stabilizes, it binds, very tightly binds to SIRT6 and stabilizes the protein and leads to higher expression of that. So the structural effect of the protein is therefore improved.
But isn't that opening the door to huge potential for your drug then? I think, I mean, as far as I'm the least expert, I have a business background, but out of curiosity, leaky gut is the root cause of many problems, basically. So it means that the gut wall not only allows nutrients to pass into the body, but also toxic materials, let's call it this way. Then it ends up in the liver, destroys the liver, damages the liver. Then it goes up into the brain, destroys the brain and all other organs, basically. At one point in time, will fail. And when you close the door, I mean, if you understand it right, so you shut the door and say, okay, now toxic substances, your time is over. You go, you're flushed out and you can't enter the body. Is that the right picture of your drug, of the potential?
Exactly.
So really cool.
This is the plan. This is the concept. And this is, as I said, this is not using immunosuppression, for example, which is normally the way to deal with that, to stop the reaction to the toxins or the antigens. Here, what we do is we really try to establish the natural situation, which means, okay, the gut wall is healed. And the healed gut wall will not let toxins or antigens pass through on the one hand, but also ensure the proper uptake of nutrients, because the problem with leaky gut is not that you just have too many toxins. You also lose the ability of the gut wall to take up in an active way things like vitamin B12, which is needed by the body and therefore needs to malnutrition symptoms if you don't have that. And as you said, it goes beyond what I said initially, celiac disease, ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease. But you're right, it even would include something like Parkinson's disease, where now believe that degraded bacteria are causing Parkinson's reactions. And And by stopping that, it's so-called gut-brain axis. Yeah, if you stop that, this may even help Parkinson's patients. We don't test that right now. Yeah, this is something where I think let's see how that evolves over time. We will first focus on GI indications, so everything in gastrointestinal tract should be looked at first. But the concept, I think, can clearly be expanded beyond that.
That would be really great.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
It's awesome. When you mentioned it, I said it's good enough, and you said no, it's overwhelming. So it's a matter of semantic, but this would be really game changer.
Would be a game changer, yes.
How long do you think does your team need until proving in a phase 3 setting, which is then coming after the phase 2, that in a significant big patient population, you really can restore the gut wall and, let's put it bluntly, heal it and restore the natural state?
I think that should be feasible in the phase 2 already. Mm-hmm. Because phase 2 will test enough patients for statistical readout and histology, so the healing will be part of the readout. So I think this such a study may take 1.5 to 2 years and may start end of this year or beginning of next year. So not too far, I think. It's usually just a question of resources, and it includes money to finance that. And there's always an alternative. You also can think about partnering. Mm-hmm. And therefore, with such a unique new concept, and we are first in class here. So this is the first molecule, mm-hmm. which is acting as a modulator of SIRT6 in a clinical trial. We think that it should also be exciting to the big pharma companies already at this stage, because we have such wonderful efficacy data from the phase 1 patient cohorts, good safety. We have a good production process in place. So I think it's a once in your lifetime opportunity, I think, from my
point. When I remember the conversation I had with a professor at the UCL a couple of years ago, it was in 2015-16. Yeah. His idea was that you solve the problem by binding toxins in the gut and flush them out, basically. So you leave the gut wall as it is. But his opinion was that, if I recall it right, that basically our Western lifestyle destroys the gut wall. So you can't do anything about it. If someone doesn't adhere to this super, super clean diet, no alcohol, no fun, no cakes, no sugar, and just lives an ascetic lifestyle up on a mountain, then probably this person is safe. But usually the gut wall during life at some point in time becomes leaky. Your drug then has really solves the problem. It's not just treating the symptoms, it's solving the problem.
Yeah, I think this lifestyle discussion is always going in the wrong direction, I think. Yeah. These diseases are diseases because there's something wrong in the body, which is not wrong behavior of patients, it's a genetic program. Mm-hmm. So we should not put celiac disease patients and I'm not saying you that are saying that, but just referring to some of these literature things, this is a real disease which has an organic reason that it's there. But you're right, it's associated, problems are associated to Western diet somehow, because we eat a lot of gluten-containing food because it's convenient and it tastes as well. So in Austria, I think all these Mehlspeisen stuff is really something which is everything. It contains a lot of gluten there.
Yeah, I don't want to miss it.
Well, well-paced. Yeah, it's great stuff. So
we also need some fun in life.
Yeah, absolutely. And luckily, I think I'm not a celiac disease patient, and I
really but can your drug do more? So it's one part of one part is helping celiac disease patients, but then you also have this other part, this huge lifestyle discussion that's ongoing. Can your drug then also restore the gut wall in other settings?
Yeah, if it's disease, yes. I think we can't as a biotech and medical company, you can't really develop just lifestyle. Drugs, because at the end we need to really use the money for solving medical problems, and I feel ethically a bit bound to that. Mm-hmm. Because you can spend the money only once, but there are so many things we need to solve. And I mentioned ulcerative colitis, for example. where patients right now only have immunosuppressive therapies available, which then lead to a higher risk of infections, for example, by nature. So side effects of these treatments are always there. They're intrinsic, basically. And this concept would be different. So this concept would mean, okay, we don't need to really switch off the whole immune system. We can keep it up and running and maybe just prevent or heal the gut wall independently and therefore stop symptoms as well. It's just a different way to solving the problem.
Yeah. Cool. Huge potential.
Absolutely. No, I agree. It's a multi-billion opportunity at the end, of course.
How much money does such a project consume until you get it to the regulatory authorities for final approval, market access approval?
I think that depends really on the indication and therefore how big the trials are. And if you calculate all the money you put into things which didn't work out at the end, because I think at the end, it's not about the money you put in the successful program, but the portfolio you're working on. Yeah. So I think my rule of thumbs would be $500 million right now for a molecule of that position. Mm. And the most expensive part is definitely phase 3 when you have 1,000 patients. That by itself.
What are your goals with your IMU-856 drug candidate?
I think I want to see that approved on the market and be part of the success there and can say to myself, I contributed to a reasonable improvement here. Mm. I think that's my ultimate goal. That's why I'm doing that. And 856 is such a big pleasure because it is a game-changing molecule, new mode of action. It's scientifically interesting and medically interesting. So a quite unique combination, I think.
That's good to hear. I mean, for the plans, the strategies forward I learned in my life are, you mentioned also, on one hand, partnering with the pharma industry early, out-license it, help them scientifically to move it forward, but basically leave the hard work to them. Or on the other hand, asking investors for capital to move the compound forward, either by a spin-out or in the company, or doing a mixture of those. What's your ideal plan for that compound? Do you want to take it to phase 3 and market access in your company, or are you currently looking for partnering options, investors?
Yeah, I think now we are welcome to this normal world right now, the new world, meaning it's a question of availability of financing. And I think you mentioned 2008, a lot of companies were forced to be drilled down to a single product company level. This is not good because you have a bias in what you do there. So I think we need a portfolio of things to do to work on. Phase 3, as I said, is very expensive, and luckily we are listed on NASDAQ and we have access to capital. And the company raised more than $300 million in the last 5 years, having access to NASDAQ. And therefore we are in a luxury position that we have the ability to run a phase 3 clinical trial right now in multiple sclerosis. But I doubt that we can run multiple phase 3 studies in big indications because this would just be too expensive. And therefore this is difficult to finance or impossible to finance, or at least it doesn't make sense because you dilute a lot at an early time point, which of course really is a problem then for the investor returns. And without investors, the whole thing doesn't work. So we need these investors. They're good. They know what they do, but they need to trust that the business concept here is really active and nicely working. So therefore, I believe we need to really work on both ends. We need to make sure we have proper finance and access to capital. Mm. And secondly, that we establish a trustful relationship with pharma companies, because at the end, we need an established sales force to really market the drugs. There are good examples of biotech companies which managed to really get through phase 3 and on the market, even in MS. Like recently, there was TG Therapeutics, who got their first molecule approved for treating MS. It is an anti-CD20 antibody, which is swimming in the same pool as Ocrevus from Roche. It's a nice example that companies can do this today, but it's a tough way, and you really need a lot of support from every angle to succeed in that. And therefore, I think for us, it is more attractive to balance things also in partnerships. Maybe not everything. Yeah. So I would keep that open. My professional business position here is clearly the more options you have, the better your business decision is at the end.
Mm, that's a good philosophy for business to maximize the number of options. I'm a huge fan of the BioNTech way, for example, finding a strong partner who has an established sales force already. I mean, building a sales force is a science by itself.
Absolutely. I think without Pfizer, they would have really struggled in the speed of this and distribution. There's also a distribution problem there.
And I think Moderna did it themselves, didn't they?
So they did it themselves.
So you have both possibilities on the market. Before we move to the investment focused questions, I have a few because you're listed on the NASDAQ, you mentioned. Did I miss something in running through your portfolio? Is there a question open that you would like me to ask?
No, I think there's a third program, 381, which is new.
Oh, you have the 385 one. We didn't talk about the third one yet.
Yeah, it's pretty new in preclinical. I don't talk about it because it is focusing on the, it's using our learnings from the phase, from our clinical studies. And we didn't speak about the success we recently had in an ulcerative colitis clinical trial. We did this 1 year treatment maintenance study of vidofludimus calcium in ulcerative colitis patients. And it came out so great that I thought, okay, we need to do something there. And based on the learnings there and the knowledge, we said, okay, we have also a new molecule with a similar action, but different properties. And therefore we said, okay, let's focus one of those assets to gastrointestinal diseases and following a little bit the philosophy of vidofludimus. And therefore, we started that program as a third pillar we're standing on. But that's not relevant for the current business, for the current finance discussions, because it's really early. And therefore, it doesn't play a role today. But we need to be prepared for tomorrow. If we do a deal or we get vidofludimus approved, then the question is, what's next? Yeah. And why losing time there and not using or leveraging the scientific excellence we have established here in this area and come up with something new. So that's all I can tell today about 381. But it's an important piece of the future of the company.
No, definitely. I mean, it's always, I think, a big problem in the industry when a company acquires expertise or develops expertise, then license their lead compound, and then the team just falls apart because there is nothing, no work to do. And it's always a loss for the industry when it happens.
Yeah, it's a destruction of value at the end,
I think there's a lot of value that's not tangible, that's not hard assets like buildings, but people working together, setting things together in the life science industry, in the biotech industry, especially in the clinical setting, a preclinical setting, a professional team that knows how to take a drug candidate, a potential candidate from the lab bench, move it forward into patients, and then structure the right scientists and the right clinical companies, CROs who help moving that forward to through a phase one, phase two, phase three settings, bring it to the market. This is not easy to build.
No, absolutely not. No. Sometimes I forgot how complex that was in the past. So I'm very glad we have it established right now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, this is also the discussions that we had with patents, for example, during the pandemic, where some politicians mentioned that let's just make the patents available and we solve all problems. And they always thought that's not a real problem that we have. I mean, licensing deals, this is daily business, so they are possible. The hard problem is the know-how transfer.
Good point that you bring this up. This is something which really makes me upset, because it's just honestly, and sorry for that wording, stupid thinking of some politicians. And it's an opportunistic bullshitting, basically, because you would eliminate the industry if you do this. People totally underestimate that. We can only finance these $500 million budget for getting new drugs developed if we have investors interested in getting returns. And if we don't have patents in place, we will lose it. Mm. We completely lose the attractiveness for any investor to get in. And there are some countries in the world where the governments have decided to force companies for free licenses. And in these countries, there is no longer drug development, and the availability of drugs really goes down. And if you do this in Europe or in the US, you would kill the industry. And it's really that tough. At the end, it will be all or nothing. If this goes beyond just an urgent pandemic exemption rule, because there's always a way from the public health systems to solve the problems in a way which doesn't touch the patent world at all. There's enough pressure on the industry right now, but that would really go beyond the point where we go out of business.
Now, Rich Masters in a previous podcast addressed the topic as well, and he said that it was a huge point in this year's bio in Boston to talk about it. Rich Masters is the chief marketing and public affairs officer at Biotechnology Innovation Organization. Now I have it. And in the podcast, I mean, the figures that I have in mind is that when you want to bring a novel drug to the market, so just a ballpark, so expressing it in one figure, it's these days $4 billion that someone needs to put down.
If you calculate the failed trials, yes, it's $4 billion. And this is nothing you can finance just with a little bit of public money or so. This we need the whole finance industry to support it, else it doesn't work. And look, I think maybe a big pharma company can deal with that because they have revenue streams. But you would immediately eliminate the whole biotech industry, which is just R&D focused. I think that should be something where it's not in the interest of the public to do something like that.
From my business perspective, big pharma isn't the right place to bridge the gap between science and products. It's just the structures are too big.
Well, and you'd be careful, they are my potential partners, so.
I know the big pharma, their strengths, in my opinion, are when you look at the development chain, market access, bring products to the patient, and take it up in a phase 3 settings. So there you have the big structures. When I look down at the business, for example, Evotec is doing also with your preclinical program, you need very quick, flexible teams who search for the needle in the haystack. And from my corporate experience, I think the structures of big corporations are not set up for that.
No, you're right. But I need to be careful. That's true. Somebody may listen to this podcast from sitting on the other side of a table in negotiation. Sorry.
That's true. So you have 3 programs in the development and preclinical. One at the beginning of close to phase 2, and the third one is in phase 3. That's a good, I think, for investors, also retail investors who might be interested in supporting your work by buying your shares. It's a very good risk profile.
I agree. And I think the beauty is really that The phase 3 program is really a low risk program compared to other things. Phase 2 was perfect. We're just repeating more or less in the phase 3, but we've done phase 2 with higher amount of patients. And therefore there's light at the end of the tunnel of development already there. Which I think is just for somebody who is not a day trader. I think this is, which makes sense to have a look at. Of course, there's still risk associated because any study can fail for whatever reason. And then I was talking about the celiac disease program. I think really this barrier function stuff or leaky gut, as you said, I think this is, as I said already, a once in a lifetime opportunity. And I see a huge potential in that. Also, there it's not guaranteed that it will at the end reach the market because it's part of our industry risk. But so far, it looks as good as can be at that stage of development. So that's why I really like the balanced portfolio we have right now.
If this IMU 856 program, let's put it this way, let's assume it's an ideal world and everything works 100% fine. How big, when you must express the market in a number, how big would the market be?
In
a perfect world.
It's a multi-billion opportunity, definitely. Maybe something like 5 to 10 billion.
That's a cool thing. It's a cool thing. And how much of the market do you think you can capture?
And that's something you really can't answer. I think this is, it really depends on what else is ongoing there. I think so far this is to my knowledge, the only drug which has that mode of action. Mm-hmm. And it will supplement really what's there right now. Would perfectly fit into the portfolio of a couple of companies which have, for example, antibodies for IL-23, IL-17, integrin antibodies. So it's a world where the established therapies work in some patients, but there's still a major portion of patients don't respond initially on these treatments. And combinations could be an interesting add-on here, because since we don't lower the immune system, it's something which should be good for combining with immunosuppressive drug. Mm-hmm. Maybe a later time point, but that could then open up the market access to a huge number of patients which are currently just treated in monotherapy with these kind of molecules.
That's a very good pipeline. It's impressive what you've built with your team in the last years. How old is Immunic? How old is your company?
Yeah, we started officially beginning of 17, the company.
17? It's 6 years only.
Yeah, 2016, it was legally founded. Mm-hmm. And that brings me a little back to my personal history. So the first two products came from my old company, 4NC, mm-hmm. and licensed those two molecules. And I'm very glad that we did it. And I think also it was good for 4NC at that time, because they were focusing on oncology pivotal trial and more focusing on getting some money for doing that. And we leveraged the two assets which were outside of oncology. I think that was good for everybody. And also we had then the chance to really focus on accelerated development for vidofludimus and for the, at that time, IMU-935 as a second molecule, with a very dedicated development program. And yeah, and of course, if it's your second company, you learned a lot about the do's and don'ts, and also, access to capital is much easier if you have a track record.
I saw you. You are a co-founder, basically, of Immunic.
Yes, I'm a co-founder of Immunic, and I was also co-founder of Orsin. So
that's a good track record. And now I'm curious. You mentioned that Immunic, you founded the company in Munich, in Bavaria, in Germany, which is I think one of the biggest and best ecosystems in biotech and life science we have in Europe. It's impressive what comes out of this environment, how many companies evolved out of Bavaria and Munich in the last two decades. I think every time when I look at the ecosystem, it's growing, growing, and growing, and growing.
And we were lucky part of that, because when we started 4SC at that time, it was really due to the Bavarian government support for funding, and 4SC was built. There was very good terms and conditions on the market to finance a new startup in Bavaria, and we decided to relocate. We started in Würzburg in middle of Germany, and then moved over to Martin Street, because there was a hotspot and still is the hotspot of biotech. Mm. If you then look back, basically, this is really all due to the decision of the at that time of the government to sell their stock of FIAC Intercom and to use the money for investing it in life science. And we as Immunic are still earning the fruits of that time of pretty smart political decisions, which are maybe not, they were not mainstream. I think this was really something where the politicians at that time had more visions than maybe today. It was a long lasting effort, which where I personally benefited from.
When was the decision?
It was 1997 when we started, and was all based on the first startup phase in Martin Street in 1995-96, where that high tech initiative started.
No, I think in Vienna, it was almost empty back in the 90s.
Vienna was just a little bit later. And then it's always the same. If you're early and you have a big vision, you can succeed easily.
Mm, that's true. That's true. And I have a collaboration with the Austrian stock market, and I frequently get the question, why are biotechs not interested getting listed in Europe? So what's the reason?
I have a very clear answer to that, because the legal environment is preventing biotechs from raising enough money in Europe. European law. And I went to that. Look, 4SC is a public company on Frankfurt Stock Exchange. Mm-hmm. And I think the company would have been may have been a multi-billion company at the end if we would listed the company, would have listed the company in Nasdaq. The problem is really that if you need money for growth and you want to fuel the development of the next product, you need to have enough money. You need to be able to raise more than 10-20% of your market cap. This is the problem. And then in Germany or in everywhere in Europe, you need to write a prospectus. And it may take 3 months. If you have an investor who wants to put in 20 million next morning, you need to take the money. You need to be legally able to take the money. And in a US environment, it's different. You can do that. You have access to the market. It all depends on how good you are, and do people believe that it's a good investment at that time point, and you're free to negotiate. You can have stock already prepared to given out based on the perspective. I don't see any disadvantage for investors on the US system here. It's really a disadvantage to companies because it's really blocking capital raise.
Yeah, I think the investors in the US market need to qualify first before they're allowed to enter the bigger numbers game. And in Europe, is it, if I get it right from what you said, it's the other way around, that companies are forced to do this basically checks.
Yeah, and it's so simple. It but maybe everybody can do that exercise, just look on which company raised what amount of money and in what context. And I went through both experiences, and I am pretty glad that I'm listed at Nasdaq, honestly. It's a tough world. I think it's not an easy thing, mm-hmm. but it gives the company access to what the company needs.
So you went public on the European market and on the Nasdaq?
Yes.
With Immunic or with your first company?
No, in Frankfurt with the first company, with 4C. Mm-hmm. That was in 2005. It was the only life science mm-hmm. IPO in 2005.
Congratulations.
And a tough time in market environment, but I think only the tough ones survive. And then with Immunic, we took a different route, because as a European company, the normal IPO track is a little more challenging. Mm-hmm. So we did a so-called reverse merger. So we did an offer for a company which was looking for a new future after a phase 3 failure that was based in San Diego and called Vital Therapies. And there was a competitive process, so they received something about 70 offers mm-hmm. of companies supposed to be acquired formally. And after a quite competitive process, we succeeded in getting that through. So they accepted our offer of a takeover, and then they acquired Immunic Germany. We took over 80% of the ownership, renamed the company, US company, into Immunic Inc. And since then, legally, we are a US company, and we took over the Nasdaq listing of the company.
Ah, okay. Okay.
And then also there was
smart.
That's smart, but it's also hard, because at that time point, we needed to have commitments of our current shareholders of putting in more money, because you can't go to Nasdaq with empty pockets. You will be 2 weeks. So
how is the availability of capital in the US for biotech companies? It's such a huge difference to Europe.
Yeah, it is. It can't be bigger, honestly. I think it's like 100 to 1.
Okay.
So I really think that. And if you look around, most successful companies in Europe are really listed in Nasdaq or
Yeah, almost all, I think. BioNTech, BioNTech is listed in the Nasdaq, I think 2019 or something. The only listing that I'm aware of was Intercell, in, I think also 2005, but then was acquired by a French company. Then we have Evertech, I think, listed also on the Nasdaq recently. Oh,
they both have dual listing, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, and even Morphosis was German listed. Now, after the merger, is also at Nasdaq. So it's more or less unavoidable to do that. And I, as I said, this is on the one hand being exposed to investors there, and because this is the right target audience as well, but also just the legal environment. And this is what people usually oversee in judging. This is not just talking about attractiveness of trading platforms or so. It's the legal environment, which is the problem.
I heard very often that US investors like to invest in companies that have a US story. And since you have a profound experience in getting a company listed in Europe and the United States, I would like to verify this. How about the storytelling on the US market? How challenging is it as a European company to convince investors to put their money in your company and not in some other options that they have on their own market?
I think today it's a global world. We have, I don't see any difference between being European or US. Mm. More your story, your knowledge, your reputation. Yeah, I think, of course, if you're new to the market, you don't know everybody. You don't know anybody there. So you need to knock on every door. Of course, it's a tough time. But at the end, you need to build credibility. And I think Americans don't care about where people come from. It's really more about the content and maybe the way you build your relationship. Mm. I think we have an advantage of being in German, or it would also be true for Austrian or Swiss or whatever, in that usually we don't have the tendency to oversell too much, which helps us a little bit on credibility.
The likelihood of getting a Theranos story out of Europe is pretty small.
That's maybe true. Hmm. Yeah, but on the other hand, I think we are treated fair. Hmm. And if you do something negative, it has the same effect as if American companies do something negative. If we are successful, at the end we will be at the end the market works and we will get what we deserve. And therefore, even if our market cap is not where it should be from my point of view right now.
But this is basically good for investors. I mean, there's opportunity then there.
I don't care about the current market cap if I don't raise money on that level. And at the end, it's a binary thing. Biotechs, if they succeed, it's a big, big win for everybody involved. And that's what we're working for, I think, at the end.
I mean, you have the same story, I think, for the uptake, like NVIDIA showed a couple of weeks ago. So they will play a key role in artificial intelligence, and then you have this uptake. So it's not a long linear curve. Usually on the stock market, you have this, when you have a push through, when you present your data and it works in phase three and it works in phase two, you probably have then this development of of your stock price.
Exactly, and that's what we're working for. And at the end, of course, most of the successful biotech companies at the end are acquired by one of the bigger companies. Mm. Not everybody, but a lot of those. Today, I just heard that Dice Therapeutic, which is one of our peers in the inflammation space, was acquired. Mm. Really, so this is a dynamic world. And there you, at the end, you want to get the fair price for what you have. That's should true. Be mindful of what it's currently the market cap.
That's true. What I'm interested in, when Europeans position their story in the US market, I mean, when I look at my US contacts, they're always very good in telling their story. They, as you said, tend more to oversell compared to the Europeans. What's your advice to companies who started in Europe and then want to expand to the US market, want to get to know investors, wants to get US investors on board, list on the Nasdaq? How should they prepare their storytelling, in your opinion? Should they stay European and hope that everybody accepts the European way, or should they amend their storytelling to fit the expectations of US investors, so to cut really, to really push through the noise?
I'm not sure if I'm European or US. I think what we do is more international storytelling. It's tell people the story. What's it about? Drill it down to the core. So our MS drug is positioned to change the way we treat multiple sclerosis. That's the story. It's very clear. Celiac disease program can really be a game changer in the way we treat leaky gut in the future. It'd be a multi-billion opportunity. We need to somehow make sure that the investors and the market get the message. But I don't think there is a difference between European and American companies. They're good and bad everywhere in the world.
Yeah, that's true.
My advice would just be give it a try, because at the end, just staying in the comfort zone is the wrong thing. There is no comfort zone. If we do this business, it's tough. And if we have good things, we will succeed. So my advice would be to just try it.
Yeah. And so you are in, did I get it right, San Diego?
We are based in New York City. Have an office in New York, which is also helpful. So I'm flying a lot right now, because we are turning to see investors person on a regular basis, and most of the money is sitting still in New York or in Boston.
What are your future plans for the company?
Well, I think I need to focus on the value generation side. I think my biggest issue right now is the market cap and the stock price. So, but having said that, we're quite successful right now in the clinical trials that we read out recently. I feel very optimistic and committed to develop the value story. And the second thing is, as I said, keep getting more options is great. Yeah, so therefore, business development is super important right now for the company. So we've been at BioConference as well, as most people in our industry. It was super. It was really such a nice experience to see open-minded people on the other side of the table, good discussions. It was such a fun experience for me, because I'm doing that for 2 decades. I attended first Bio in 1999. It was very small.
how big was it back then?
It was in Boston downtown center. I'm not sure, 1,000 people or 1,500 or so.
Yeah,
I was 18,000. So that was
development,
a different experience.
Yeah, good development.
And now I feel that what we are doing is the right thing at the right time. Yeah. And we need to believe in what we do and continue in execution here and getting more options on the table. And then
when are your next data points coming in?
So the next really important data point is the interim analysis of our progressive MS phase 2 study, the so-called MEDEPA study. And that's expected in the second half of this year. And the second half of this year starts in 2 weeks. So don't say the data comes out in 2 weeks. It's not expected to be the very first day of the second half, but somewhere in the middle of the second half, we expect to have.
Anyways, and IMU-856, not phase 2 data?
No, this is the progressive MS vidofludimus data. And for 856, I think we're now preparing the phase 2b study. And we will submit an IND to the FDA. We are planning this international study, exploring how big it is or should be. We have a good draft for the protocol in place, which was discussed with global KOLs, really on making sure we're doing the right things, we're measuring the right endpoints. To establish the right dose for phase 3.
Sounds like a good opportunity currently on the table. No investment advice, no medical advice, but basically there is some upside.
There's upside. And you see, anyhow, the team here is very committed as well. So
I mean, since you are listed on the Nasdaq, everybody can buy stocks or shares anytime. But are you also looking for raising capital? Are you also looking for investors who increase your cash position in the near term?
Yeah, that's always a difficult question, because it means dilution, and it means that you pay a price, you accept something for this. Yeah, there's no free lunch in this world. But yes, I think clearly what we would be interested in having, considering something like a raise, which may pave the way for full readout of the phase 3 data study. But that's something I can't throw over the counter here today. It's something we need to be prepared. So we are not actively raising money in that respect. Mm-hmm. But we are talking to investors to build up the trustful relationship, to be prepared if the timing is good for doing a capital increase.
But you would be open for discussions, sure, if someone reaches out?
Yeah, for good investors which share our vision, basically. Mm-hmm.
Sounds like a great opportunity. Like a great opportunity. How can investors reach you?
Oh, they can just reach us through the homepage. We have this IR section on the homepage, and Jessica, our head of investor relations, is taking care about all of these interactions, and we're pretty responsive if people are asking.
Mm-hmm. I'm almost at the end of my questions. I would like first to ask you, did I miss anything in this recording? Is there any point that you would like to address before we?
No, I think we covered most of the things. And I think you drilled it down to the point. It's an exciting thing.
Mm-hmm. Sounds
it's
like
fun. It has some ethical value, but also has some financial value to do what we do, because I think bringing something from idea to an approved medicament, which with a multi-billion sales opportunity, that's a economic interesting thing. And therefore, the good thing is today that our market is stable enough and evolved enough that everybody can be part of that, if people like. Yeah, it's an interesting industry, and Corona showed us that the life science industry is helpful for the world to survive. And everybody can be part of that.
I couldn't agree more. I think our life expectations in the West and also in the rest of the world is increasing. And I think one crucial part of this development is basically the pharma and the life science industry. Without that industry, we'll probably still have to expect to not grow older than 32, 35 years old. So. Mm-hmm. So it's a very fantastic industry. Let me ask you my final question. I mean, when you look back at your journey with Immunic and your over two decades experience in the industry, what are the three key lessons that you learned along the way that you would share as an advice to someone who wants to start their first company now?
Yeah, maybe three things. First of all, just do it. Yeah, it's an execution focused thing. You need to be prepared to execute and to do something and to try. And this is a trial and error thing. You need to learn from the failure, and you need to learn from the successes of yourself, so to build up your own world of experience and your own coordinate system to succeed there. The second thing is, and that's maybe the tough thing, to expect the unexpected, to be prepared. And we talked about serendipity, where I believe Darwinism in our industry means you need to adapt to the changes, because technology changes can be very quick, and good companies can adapt to that very quickly. But you mentioned BioNTech as the best example. After the IPO, it was challenging for them, but then with Corona, they very quickly adapted to the new environment and made the best out of that. It's quite impressive how Uber was doing that. And therefore, I really, really think this was one of the best examples of a quick adaption to a new environment. And the third piece is don't get isolated. Be part of the global ecosystem. Talk to people. Talk to other companies, investors, everywhere. You can learn so much that there's no limit. Yeah, you can just give it a call or whatever you do, talk. Because more or less, if you start somewhere in Europe or in the US or whatever, it doesn't matter if you are open-minded and you believe that you're part of a global ecosystem.
Daniel, thank you very much for this fantastic conversation. I enjoyed every single minute and learned a lot of new things from you. And I like the idea of 856. It really sounds like a great opportunity.
Yeah. Also, thank you for that wonderful interview. It's really good to have also enough time to talk. Usually it's always very short. And here, I think it's a lot where I can even learn in this discussion here. And I hope that also I can contribute a little bit to the education and learning of others about what we are doing and what the industry is doing.
Thank you very much for sharing your story. And I wish you and your team all the best for the future and bring your drugs to the market and help the patients.
Thanks a lot.
Have a great day. Bye.
Bye-bye.
What a journey that was with Dr. Daniel Witt. Today we learned that being early and having a grand vision isn't just an advantage. It's a strategy for success. Navigating international markets is a wild but necessary ride for global impact and comfort zones. They are the silent killers of innovation. Break free and the world becomes your laboratory. If this conversation sparked something in you, we need your help to keep this fire burning. Hit that like button, drop a comment with your thoughts, and if you haven't already, subscribe to the channel. It's a small click for you, but a giant leap for this podcast. And don't keep this conversation to yourself. Share this episode with your friends, your family, or anyone you think needs to hear it. Your engagement doesn't just make my day. It helps attract more incredible speakers like Daniel, which means more groundbreaking content for you. Thank you for being part of this journey. Until next time, keep questioning, keep learning, and keep growing.